resistor on each end, and you don't see any obvious open circuit there, you could very gently touch the center conductor with a pair of needle nose pliers and see if the center conductor will rotate, meaning it's got a broken connection. If it's really a soldered down center conductor, very gentle torque applied with needle nose pliers should show that it will not turn. The fact that you've got a whole lot of insertion loss on the straight through line and infinity on center pin to center pin sounds like a defect, John. Yeah, there is a possibility that there's a coupling capacitor in there and the thing is only supposed to work above some number of megahertz. You said you saw a little bit of capacitance effect. What kind of instrumentation were you using when you saw that capacitance effect, John? Go ahead.
When I used an analog ohmmeter, I could notice a slight kickback. So there is a capacitance effect. I was talking to Eric about it during the week. That's probably the conversation you heard. And he said it was possible that it could be some other device, but it's labeled directional coupler, and HP doesn't usually label them incorrectly.
Okay, so on your highest ohmmeter scale, you did see a little bit of a kick of capacitance on the center conductor to ground. Did you do that test from each end? If you measure that kick ground on what? But you didn't measure that kick on the other side. That would give you an indication of something that's not right. Did you do it to both sides? Come on, John, did you do it? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick. Slight difference in the kick. One had a little more charge than the other one had, but they both responded the same way. I did check both ends of the direct line.
It sounds to me like it's time to take that apart, John, even though it's very difficult to open. You may have to drill out some rivets or whatever. You own it. Right now, in its current form, it's very difficult to use. And a broadband, multi-octave, Hewlett-Packard directional coupler is a very useful thing. I think it's time you put it back into operation. 50 ohms on the directional line is a good sign, necessary but not sufficient. But open circuit on the straight-through line, that's almost always bad news. It's time to open it up. Are you going to have to drill out rivets to open up that cover, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick. It's all Allen screws. There's about 10 or 15 Allen screws that hold this thing together from the ends and separate plates on each of the connectors, on the end connectors. They have to be removed, too. It's really a complicated mess. But, yeah, that's what I thought. It was going to have to come apart to be fixed, but I just wanted to check with you before. It's a very expensive-looking item, and I don't want to damage it. But, okay, I guess I'll just have to open it up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to you opening that up. And there isn't a scorpion in there with a year's supply of food, so don't worry. You're careful enough. You're not going to be losing those Allen screws. You'll always be able to put it back together again. Use the right kind of an Allen wrench where you don't strip it. You won't even be putting any marks on that case, John. Yeah, you're going to break the glue bond or the paint bond a little bit around the screws. Big deal. And something as valuable as that Hewlett-Packard device, even if the screw shows that they've been opened up, that's, in my opinion, to a person who knows what he's looking at, that's not going to affect its value. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, all of the Allen head screws still have the original paint on them. Nobody had a wrench in there, so it was never taken apart. So I'll just carefully take it apart. And I don't even know. You know, the Narda couplers are so simple. You take the screws out and it breaks in half. Not this thing. It's got end caps and it's got an L plate on the top. It's really, really wild. Had to be a lot of money. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the first question.
Yeah, what is the rated coupling and rated frequency range on that thing, John?
1 to 2 gig and 20 dB down at the couple ports.
Yeah, at first, that doesn't sound like a very exotic design. My guess is the thing is about 8 inches long from left to right side.
A little longer than that, probably 10. I was saying 12, but it's probably 10 inches. And 2.5 by 3 inches box frame.
So 2.5 to 3 inches from top to bottom. How thick is the box?
2.5 inches in one direction, 3 inches in the other direction.
That's a rather beefy item. Amazing. That's going to be fun to take apart. That's going to be an interesting thing to look inside of, John. And there's going to be a little bit of rare ammonium and unobtainium in there, John.
I thought I'd find mega gigabucks. Right? But I cannot imagine why it is so heavy. It has to have a lot of fill area in there, because none of the couplers are anywhere near as heavy as this. So, strange stuff.
We're looking forward to hearing what you say. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. I'm going to the first question here. Now, all right. Everybody has heard that when you have a full-length antenna and then you want to make it smaller, Q goes up, you lose a little bit of bandwidth. Well, what they're asking on this one, in fact, there were two questions this week on this bandwidth. If you had a 80-meter antenna, full length, and it was set up, and you reduced it by half, okay, so the Q is going to change. But what would you consider a good bandwidth for the full length antenna? What should it be, if you know? KC2WGB.
Yeah, one of the recent articles in QST magazine, I think I've got the latest issue right here, in the Doctor Is In section, is where I think it was, gives you a picture. My vague memory was that an 80-meter dipole, full half-wave dipole in 80 meters, if your criteria is where does it hit 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, I think it covers roughly one-third of the band. The 80-meter band is 3.5 to 4.0, 500 kc wide. One-third of that is probably in the vicinity of 300 kilohertz. So around one-third of the band is where a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters will hit 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. You go through the mathematics of that, and I think it turns out to be a Q of around 10. So bandwidth divided by center frequency, vice versa, center frequency divided by bandwidth, very roughly a 10-to-1 ratio on a full dipole. As you start making the dipole shorter, that bandwidth goes down fairly fast, and it's not a linear relationship. If you made the dipole half of the normal length, you would think you would have twice the Q. I think you'd have quite a bit more than that. Rough numbers. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
Okay, very good. So then, if you're operating at 80 meters and with a full-length antenna, your tuner should only actually have to tune 3 times to cover the whole band that you're operating in. So if you cut that to half its length, are you saying that would be 6 tuner operations to cover that, basically?
Something along that line, John. On top of that, I just told you the bandwidth where it hits 2-to-1. Many modern-day no-tuned radios will not tolerate a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. They start getting a little bit flaky at 1.5 and 1.6 standing wave ratio. So quite possibly you're going to have to tune it more often than that. And why can I not find the article right now? But it was in one of the recent issues, either the last month, the November issue, or the October issue of QST, Doctor Is In, or Technical Topics. One of those sections did show you, that's where I think it was, it's an impossibility, it was the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation magazine of the IEEE. No, I doubt it. They don't go down anywhere near that low, that simplistic, to get down to a single dipole, if you know what I mean. They got much, much more elaborate antennas. So I'll try to find it. But I think if you assume the Q is 10, in other words, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio bandwidth divided into the center frequency is roughly a 10-to-1 ratio, and you're going to be tuning more often than that because, as I said before, the most rigs start becoming unhappy at around 1.5, 1.6 standing wave ratio. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
DC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, I'm sure the questioner now has something that he can track down and he has an answer to his question. All right, now I'll let it drop and go on to the next question.
Was he asking that question, John, because he's wondering if something's wrong with his antenna because it seemed to be too narrow?
Well, the reason he's asking the question is he has an iffy tuner. It seems the word he says, and he's worried because he has to reduce the size of his 80-meter antenna. It's much too big for the property, and he's getting complaints. So he's going to try making it maybe two-thirds of its normal length. I think he can go down. He doesn't have to go to half, but somewhere maybe two-thirds. He's going to be playing with it, and he just wants to know if it was going to work with its tuner.
The fact that he has to physically lower the length, tip-to-tip length of his, let's say, 80-meter dipole, which ordinarily would need 132-foot of length, and his property is not 132-foot wide, we'll say. There's lots and lots of solutions to that. That length, the 132 feet, doesn't have to be all flat out parallel to the ground. You can take the ends of that, bend it down, bend them down vertically, put top hat capacitors, put loading coils in the center. There's all kinds of ways you can make the antenna electronically a lot longer than its physical length. And if you do it by those kind of tuning techniques, you don't sacrifice the bandwidth quite as fast as strictly making it shorter and trying to tune it with the antenna tuner. Let me drop
WS2N.
Let's see what Paul's going to say on this one. Now, Paul, you probably had the... Well, you've got a good-sized piece of property, so I don't think it's much of a problem for you, but what did you do to squeeze down your size of antenna? If that's what you had to do. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, but really the question that John put out there for this fellow was, what kind of SWR did you get, you know, with a half wave antenna? Mine's 134 feet dipole. So, I mean, I got a figured for CW. In fact, I have that on in the background. I was just looking at the SWR. It's like 2-1 at the low end of 80, and when you get to the high end on the phone portion, you know, 3.900 or something like that, it's probably like 6-1 or something. But, you know, naturally with the antenna tuner, that's going to take that right out. So no problem, of course, operating the whole band. But if I was to shorten it, that might be a different story. But, I mean, I thought the question really was, what was he looking at from, you know, one end to the other? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I see what the problem is here. I picked up the issue on top of the pile. I thought it was the November issue. It was the October issue. I think the November issue has got a nice curve of standing wave ratio versus frequency for dipoles of a couple of different altitudes above the ground, if I remember correctly. But it's in the ballpark of what we're talking about. So, to make cover the whole 80-meter band is quite a serious challenge without doing some elaborate other things. But there's lots of ways of squeezing the antenna down mechanically, electronically keeping it tuned, and you get a little bit more bandwidth by doing it that way as opposed to doing it strictly on the antenna tuner. Because when you do it on the antenna tuner in the shack, at the far end of the transmission line, you do simultaneously start picking up a significant amount of transmission line standing wave ratio caused insertion loss. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
KC2WGB. Well, at least he knows he has a shot at getting it done. Other people are using trimmed antennas, and the only thing is, I don't know if his tuner is going to be able to cover exactly what he's going to wind up with when he makes it shorter, but I'm sure if he plays back and forth with the length, he may be able to make the tuner happy.
There's one other thing worth considering here, John. If you plot on the Smith chart the areas where your antenna tuner will give you a perfect match, and there's other areas in the chart where it doesn't make it, every antenna tuner has got a certain map like that. And if your particular antenna tuner won't match your particular antenna, before you give up, change the length of the transmission line between the antenna and the tuner. When you add extra transmission line, what you're doing is you're walking around the perimeter of the Smith chart, and you can easily walk your particular antenna impedance from a point on the chart where the antenna tuner can't handle it, all the way around to a place where it can handle it. So So before you give up, add some extra of cable. Over to you, John.
Good suggestion. Yes, that may help. Well, we'll just have to... there's no way to give him exact ways of doing it, but if he plays around with it a little bit and finds out the range of his tuner that makes him happy, he may be able to, like you said, either add some to it or take some away, whatever makes the tuner happy, and I'm sure he'll get it to work. All right, I'll let it drop. We'll go on to the next one. All right, Dick. We had mentioned, and you spoke about the Bessel null function last week. Okay, and that was covered very well. This same gentleman is asking a question. He wants to understand conversion gain. What are they describing with that, and why is that necessary to understand? So I know you've got that down pat, so give him a little instructions. KC2WGB.
I hear the word conversion gain. I don't know yet the subject. Are we talking about an operational amplifier, an afterburner on a transmitter? Are we talking about something to do with FM modulation? Or what's the subject matter of this particular question, John? Go ahead.
He's reading a chapter on IF and different systems, and the term conversion gain was used in the structure of the IF for checking the system, and he can't find any decent literature on it yet, so he just wanted to know what should he do, and in the case of the IF or the mixer, what would that mean?
Okay. When it comes to the modern day mixers that you can use in a radio, particularly a solid state radio, some of them are purely passive diode mixer. Some of them are active electronics mixers. Some of them contain arrays of transistors doing a mixing function. Okay. Ordinary purely passive diode mixer, a doubly balanced mixer, typically has an insertion loss of around 7 or so dB. In other words, if on the RF port you put in a 0 dBm signal, the local oscillator port, maybe you're putting in a plus 15 dBm signal because the mixer manufacturer recommends that level of mixing, LO. And so 0 dBm goes into the RF port, and the mixer mixes down to the IF, and the IF signal comes out at minus 7 dBm. In that example, that would be 7 decibels of conversion loss. Okay. I could, if I wanted to, go out and buy the right kind of a solid-state device which has active transistors doing the mixing function. The possibility exists that instead of having 7 decibels of loss, they could easily have 7 decibels of gain. Let me drop. Because the input frequency of the mixer and the output frequency that you use are not the same frequency, it has been doing a frequency conversion for you. However, the standard that's used is what power in either milliwatts or decibels, dBm, goes in, what power in milliwatts or decibels comes out, and the ratio between the two, because it is a change in level, it's called a change in gain or loss, because it's a change in frequency, it's called conversion. Now, if I use another example, my 10 gigahertz transverter, this is a little box made by SSB Electronics, you put into it approximately a plus 10 dBm signal at 144 megacycles. It does mixing, it's got various stages of gain, it's got an output final stage, and out comes 200 milliwatts. Let me drop. So 200 milliwatts on a barefoot SSB 10 gigahertz transverter in the transmit mode. 200 milliwatts is, let me think, plus 23 dBm. I'm putting in 10 milliwatts, that's plus 10 dBm. So therefore the difference between plus 10 going in and plus 23 coming out is 13 dB, if I got the mathematics right. So it has 13 decibels of conversion gain. The SSB transverter that I use, it's got 13 decibels of transverting gain in the transmit mode. In the receive mode, I think the gain is a little bit higher than that. 10 gigs coming back in for reception, gets mixed down to 144, goes into my tunable IF receiver, my 2 meter all mode. Let me drop. And I think in the receive mode, that transverter has closer to 15 decibels of gain. So 13 decibels of transverter gain on transmit, either 15 or maybe even 20 dB of gain in the receive mode, because it uses a slightly different low noise amplifier in the receive mode. So the fact that you're moving in frequency means it's a converter. The fact that the input power and the output power are different, either up or down, is either gain or loss. So the gain of a transverting device can be negative in decibels because it's got some loss, or positive in decibels because it's got some gain. But maybe that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I'm sure it'll make a lot of sense to him now. At least he has an idea of what they're talking about. Evidently, the description may have passed over the definition of that gain factor, but at least he has an idea now. So when there is a conversion and you could have a negative loss, or like you said, if you use something with amplification, you could have a gain. So that's actually what they're measuring, whether it's a loss or it's a gain. Okay, I'll let it drop. We'll move on to the next one. Alrighty, I have a gentleman here who's using filters in the audio frequencies, and he doesn't have a lot of equipment. He would like to know that when you filter an original signal, and whether you use a low pass or high pass or a combination of them, how much of the original signal can be counted on to be reproduced effectively pure with all of that filtering that's necessary to get what he wants. How much loss in the original fidelity do you think he'll have, and is there a percentage to guide him? Or that's basically what he's doing, but it's all in audio frequencies, and he knows about things like the Joe Taylor stuff for pulling these signals out, but he has no equipment. So evidently he does have these filters though, so maybe give him a little quick course on filtering.
Yeah, you might have a little bit more smarts than you know about on this one now. Is he using a Collins crystal filter? IF strip? I doubt it, but it could be. Is the filter made out of inductors and capacitors? Is it a commercially made product, something he's homebrewing? Is it a filter made out of resistors and capacitors? What kind of audio filter do you think we're talking about here, John? And the reason for the filtering, are we trying to get rid of high-frequency noise that's present, like a background noise that's above the frequency of the audio he cares about, or a 60-cycle hum? So what do you believe is the nature of what he's trying to eliminate, and why is he about to use an audio filter? What kind of a filter do you think he's using, John? Give me a couple of guesses on some of those before we proceed. K2RIW.
The only equipment he seems to have, he has a collection of these Kronheit filters, low pass, high pass, and band reject, all in the audio. It's all from, let's see, 100 kilohertz and down. So that's what he's using, and he's trying to eliminate, from what I gather, noise in phone conversations. So, maybe you got a tip.
Yeah, I've seen some of these very nice lab-type Kronheit filter assemblies. They've got some nice dials on the front where you can dial in the low-pass frequency, the high-pass frequency, the notch frequency, and so on. And some of those devices have very, very low insertion loss. You put in a 0 dBm, 600 ohm audio signal, and what comes out is only going to have a dB or two or three of loss, not a great deal of loss. And the filtering function is a very nice curve published by the manufacturer showing you exactly how fast it rolls off. Now, if I'm listening to single sideband signals on the 20 meter band, and there's two or three guys in there on almost the same channel, they're almost on top of each other, and so I'm hearing the desirable audio, and I'm hearing some squeaky sounds from the guy a little bit further up the band, and I'm hearing some grumbling sounds from the guy a little bit lower down in the band, and they're in there simultaneously. But the undesired signals, in my example, are in the audio bandpass we care about. Let me drop. For communication purposes, I'd like to be able to pass all of the audio frequencies from roughly 300 hertz to about 3 kilohertz. Below 300 hertz, you get some nice mellow sound, but doesn't give you very much extra intelligibility. Up at 3 kilohertz, it's very important. Some of these super sharp filters you can buy cut off real fast at 2 kilohertz, and the region from 2 kilohertz to 3 kilohertz is chopped away, or even 1.8 kilohertz up to 3 kilohertz is chopped away, and now the speech starts sounding kind of muffled. So you want to pass, in my opinion, 300 to 3 kilohertz for good communication range on two-way radios. If it's a telephone circuit, you'd like to go a little bit further than that. I'd like to go from 100 hertz to about 5 kilohertz when it comes to a good telephone circuit. A filter that passes those frequencies is not going to be able to eliminate other undesirable signals that fall into that exact frequency region. The filter doesn't have intelligence to know what you consider human speech and what you consider garble. The filter doesn't have that smart. Now, because for two-way radio communication region, you don't need much above 3 kilohertz, and some of the undesired signals, if they happen to be 4, 5, 6, and 10 kilohertz, a sharp cutoff filter eliminating those will definitely help. And if there's a lot of grumble and hum coming through below 300 hertz, a sharp filter cutting those off will help. But any of the frequencies that fall in the normal 300 to 3 KC region, your filter is not going to take that out. Even digital signal processing is not going to take that out. There's one slight exception to this, and that is if there are two guys in there running amplitude modulation and their carriers happen to be, let me pick a number, 1.5 kilohertz apart. So while you're hearing those two chunks of audio, you're also hearing this very strong tone of 1.5 kilohertz because of the two carriers of these AM transmitting signals. Sideband doesn't do that, but AM does. Two carriers on AM 1.5 kilohertz apart are going to give you a very strong 1.5 kilohertz tone, the beep note, so to speak. And now, if in your filter bag of tricks, you've got a notch filter, and you can tune that notch filter to 1.5 kilohertz, that's the one example of where undesired signals within the passband can be eliminated and make a huge improvement. Let me drop. And once you use that notch filter that I just described, you're still passing the audio from 300 kilohertz to 3 kilohertz, but there's this notch at 1.5 kilohertz. And you take 300 to 3 kilohertz with a notch at 1.5, and you listen to human speech through that. It'll sound pretty good. Not perfect, but you'll understand what the guy is saying. So in that case, using a notch filter in the audio passband can give you an improvement. But other than that example, if you think you're going to use digital signal processing to eliminate random noise or other undesired signals in the audio bandpass, not very likely. So maybe that helps a little bit, John. Filters can help. And by the way, when it comes to fidelity, any reasonable filter made out of passive components, in other words, it doesn't have any amplifiers that are saturating and overloading and whatever, whatever audio quality you've got going into the filter as far as the past frequencies are concerned, the 300 to 3 kilohertz frequency region, the filter almost has no ability to change the quality of the signal to noise ratio, the, what's the word for it now, whether or not there's a crossover distortion and flat topping and square waves and whatever. Your filter cannot eliminate undesirable characteristics that are in the passband. It also can't create them. Your filter, any reasonable passive filter, can't create undesired signals unless you're overloading it in some way. So the fidelity going in and the fidelity coming out of the passband frequencies should be almost the same. KC2 WGB, K2LAW.
KC2 WGB. Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you, Dick, on the passband. If it's in there, it's going to pass through. Now, maybe he is not looking to get audio information parsed out, maybe he does have a specific frequency that's within the passband that he can take out. That is a possibility, like I said. And, of course, the bandwidth of what you parse out is going to make it, the breadth of that band is going to make more difficult to understand the conversation, that's for sure. But, yeah, that's a tough one. If it's a simple hum, yeah, he can do something about that. But if it's in the audio frequency range, I think he's going to have a lot of difficulty with that. Alrighty, I'll let it drop and go on to the last one.
And by the way, on the subject of that notch filter, there are types of notch filters that are very, very narrow. And there are types of notch filters that are quite broad. If you use the right kind of a circuit that has a very narrow notch filter, and you want to notch out one or two very specific tones that are in there, you can get a lot of improvement with very little detriment with the right kind of circuitry. Over to you, John, KTRIW.
Yes, very true, Dick. I have four of those Kronheit filters, all different multi-functions that they have. Some of them have all of the functions of the filter, and some are just band pass or band reject, and they work extremely well. And they're not that large. They're very small, very light, and they do a good job. Alrighty, you let it drop. Okay, this young gentleman wants to know about equalization. Where is it used and why is it used? What is the purpose of equalizing, whether it's signals or tones? Why do they do that and what is the function? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
There are quite a few different kinds of equalization. One of the first one that comes to mind is the one that's used for cable television reception systems. If in your particular town there's a cable system, the head-end amplifier is picking up all of the channels, and the actual frequencies going down the cable probably are as low as 40 megahertz and as high as maybe 400 megahertz. And they usually put something like 10 amplifiers per mile in the cable because the signal is continuously getting lost because there's quite a few miles of cable between the head-end amplifier and the final customer at the other end of the town. And the nasty characteristic of coaxial cable is that it has more insertion loss at higher frequencies than at lower frequencies. So that frequency region you want to send down the cable, 40 megahertz to 400 megahertz, in my example, let me drop. That last customer down the end might have 15 or 20 decibels more loss at 400 megs versus 40 megs, and he wants to receive every one of those channels. At first you say to yourself, okay, I know that it's going to be 20 decibels of extra loss. I'll just make the signal at the higher frequencies 20 dB stronger at the beginning. Sounds good. Not the right answer. The reason it's not the right answer is because you got a whole lot of amplifiers in between, and that super strong signal at 400 megs that you're issuing at the beginning of the cable is going to overload those first couple of amplifiers, and those first few customers are going to get too strong a signal. Therefore, they tend to use equalization on each and every amplifier. Each individual amplifier has what I'm going to call a tilt circuit in there. In other words, it's got a circuit that, depending on how you turn the knob, so to speak, and there may not really be knobs, it may be purely electronic, but depending on how you turn the knobs, you can decide to dial in how much extra gain that amplifier has at 400 megs versus 40 megs. In fact, the way cable television usually works, let me drop a call, is that in my particular example, I could design a cable system so that I'm sending down there 40 or 50 channels, from 40 megs to 400 megs, and I'm also sending down there two individual pilot tones. One pilot tone is at 39 megacycles, one pilot tone is at 405 megahertz. And now I've got a circuit in each and every one of those amplifiers that looks at the ratio of the amplitude of the high frequency pilot tone versus the low frequency pilot tone, and the circuit dials itself in to the right amount of slant equalization, slant of frequency gain versus gain versus frequency, so that it ends up with the exact same amplitude of the two pilot tones. The reason why that's a smart thing to do is that now every one of the amplifiers is seeing the exact same amplitude of all of those signals. Therefore, no one of those signals is saturating. Every one of the customers is happy because they're all seeing the same amplitude. And beyond that, let me drop. Coaxial cable has another very nasty characteristic. On a hot day, the cable has more loss at the higher frequencies. Not as much loss at the lower frequencies, but it's got more loss everywhere on a hot day. So the fact that these individual amplifiers are adjusting, looking for the upper pilot tone and the lower pilot tone, and adjusting their slant in gain to keep those pilot tones equal in amplitude at each and every one of the amplifiers, you can see how the system is not only keeping itself flat, but is adjusting itself for a winter day versus a summer day. Cable, well-designed cable television systems do that. That's one kind of equalization. Another kind of equalization is that I could decide that my particular voice is a little bit too boomy, got too much low notes to it, and I could use an audio equalizer, one of these things that's got a whole bunch of slide switches. One of the slide switches is adjusting the frequencies around 50 hertz. Another one is adjusting the amplitude of around 80 hertz. Another one 120 and so on. When you've got one of these audio equalizers and you adjust each one of those slides switches the correct way, I, in theory, can make my voice sound better, even though my microphone has got some funny characteristics, my voice has got some funny characteristics, the echo in the room's got some funny characteristics, and when I properly adjust that audio equalizer, I can probably make some improvement. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Now, I'm assuming the pilot frequencies are, one is at the very low end and one is at the upper end, so that they can get full coverage. And by the way, you might want to explain to people why that change in the coax on the high frequencies takes place, and yet the low seems to be able to respond properly. You might want to run that by them. KC2WGB.
When you look at the data sheet for almost any coaxial cable that you can buy, the data sheet usually is a graph where the horizontal frequency is megahertz, horizontal dimension is megahertz, and the vertical dimension is decibels on a log-log piece of paper. So it's a log-log piece of paper. Frequency is represented horizontally in a logarithmic manner, and decibels of loss is represented vertically on a logarithmic piece of paper. And throughout most of the frequency range of the cable you're buying, you'll notice that the curve is a fairly straight slanted line. It's slanted up at about a 30 degree angle is the usual way to graph it, and you'll see that from that graph, all coaxial cable has more loss at higher frequencies, even at a fixed temperature. And as you increase the temperature, that loss at the higher frequencies increases even more. Let me drop. And the first question a person might ask when he looks at that graph is, why in the world does the cable have more loss at higher frequencies? And there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is the so-called skin effect. In other words, your center conductor of your coax cable might be an 1/8-inch diameter solid chunk of copper. However, at your favorite frequency, 20 meters, 14 megacycles, the RF energy may only couple down into that copper center conductor a 1/10,000th of an inch, the so-called skin effect, and the RF does not go any deeper. And how deep does the RF go is a function of 1 over square root of frequency. As you go to higher frequencies, the skin depth gets more and more narrow. That's just the way conductors operate at radio frequencies. Since less and less copper is conducting the signal at higher and higher frequencies, you have more resistive loss at that RF frequency from your center conductor, from your outer conductor. Let me drop. That's loss factor number one. That's the one that creates the 30-degree angle on the chart. And as you look at the far right-hand side of the chart, if the manufacturer has gone far enough, you notice the end of the chart has another hookup at the end. In other words, the curve suddenly increases in slope at the end, and that's where the dielectric loss starts taking over. In other words, the polyethylene, the Teflon, or whatever that's suspending the center conductor in that cable, at certain frequencies, it has more loss. Tends to be more loss at higher frequencies, polyethylene in particular. So the actual insertion loss as a function of frequency is a function of square root. In other words, if I go four times higher in frequency, most coaxial cable, square root of 4 is 2, most coaxial cable, whatever number of decibels per 100 feet the cable has at frequency 1, frequency 4 times higher than that, it's going to have twice those number of decibels. Square root of frequency 1 over is due to the copper loss. And the dielectric loss tends to be a little bit closer to unity. You start adding the unity to the 1 over the square root of frequency function, and you get this funny hookup at the end of the frequency response to the cable. So all cable, more loss at higher frequencies, more loss at higher temperatures, and these are some of the mechanisms of where the loss is coming from. KC2, WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, if you could just elaborate on the one thing you mentioned, the skin effect changing with temperature. How is that done?
If you measure 1,000 feet of 14-gauge copper wire on a cold day, you'll measure some number of ohms. Measure that exact same 1,000 feet of 14-gauge copper wire on a hot day, you'll measure a larger number of ohms. Copper has a positive temperature coefficient versus a positive temperature coefficient. Higher temperature, more loss. You're about to ask me what's the mechanism inside of the copper that it has more loss. A little bit of it is because of spacing. In other words, the copper expands when you heat it up. That's a minor factor, but it's one of the factors. I've got a whole bunch of electrons running around in there rather freely. In other words, each individual copper atom inside of your cable has an electron in the outer ring that's very free to roam wherever it wants to. When the cable is hotter, those atoms of each individual copper atom, they're vibrating in space. They're all held together in a matrix, but they're vibrating faster at a higher temperature. That's what your thermometer measures. How fast are they vibrating? So something about the way the individual electrons are bound or not bound to that outer ring on each individual copper atom, and the way they behave at a higher temperature, by some means, they don't do quite what you want to do, and therefore the number of ohms you measure at a higher temperature is higher. That's the main factor. On top of that, I think the dielectric material itself has a little bit more loss at a higher temperature. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. I think that completes it. I just thought that little bit of a note should have been applied because they may not have understood why it was happening to the center conductor. Okay, well, that's it from the mailbag. And thanks for everybody participating. And great things coming in on the email. Love it. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, Paul's now going to tell us what's going on in space. And so, Spaceship 2 has had a slight failure. One of the two pilots died. My guess is they're doing a little bit of investigation to find out why the drag device was turned on at the wrong time, which is apparently the main contributing factor to that particular accident. And more and more companies are entering the space launch business. And so it looks like National Aeronautics and Space Administration is going to be a prime contractor. It's going to be a, prime director, if you know what I mean. They're the customer, and they're going to a whole bunch of other companies to supply the space hardware for them, a whole bunch of vendors. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, NASA really has done that, you know, for decades. Even early on, you know, with Rockwell and all, you know, they built these Apollo spacecraft. But the difference is NASA had them built into their specifications. But now they're telling the companies, private companies, you know, go out and do it your way. Do whatever you think is right, and you know, we'll pay you for it. So I think that's the big difference, what's going on, and I think it's a good way to go. And we have both programs really.
really in effect. Commercial and the private, NASA's still doing what they did forever ago. You have the Orion spacecraft going to be tested out this December 4th, and they're going to send that two orbits around the Earth, almost 4,000 miles high, and they're going to test this thing out, unmanned, of course, and they're going to see how it performs. So we have both. You have the Orion Space Launch System being developed by NASA to eventually travel to asteroids, maybe the moon, and eventually to Mars. Got the commercial people picking up the slack, going to International Space Station, eventually doing their own scientific flights, like SpaceX plans on doing with the Dragon, launching it up for weeks or even maybe a year at a time and bringing it back unmanned. They call that Dragon Lab. You've got the private industry heavily involved. Maybe a potential space station being built by Bigelow. He's got plans of doing an inflated space station, inflated modules, and then you'll have another place to go besides the International Space Station. And in fact, he's going to test out one of his modules, see how it works for a long time in space. They're going to attach it to the space station probably the end of next year. SpaceX has been contracted by Bigelow to put this thing on board and attach it to the space station, plate it, and see how it goes. Stays, intact for, a year or so. They'll probably be good to go, and then next thing you know, Bigelow will be signing up for private contractors to put his inflatable sections up in space. A long time off, but definitely written in the stars. As far as the spacecraft that blew up, that unfortunately killed one guy and injured the other, Virgin Galactic, I think will be putting the brakes on for probably at least a year. They have to do an investigation with that. I read the same thing, that the tethering device. I was never crazy about this thing in the first place. I saw Spaceship One. They had the same system. They'd go up there, and on the way back, it looks like the this whole craft, jackknifes, separates the two fuses, like where the two fuselages are. You got the main section going back, and you got a fuselage on one side and another one on the left, and that's a big hinge, and that's what they use to float in descent. They don't have a parachute, and apparently that failed, didn't hold or whatever, or was released too early. Unknown reasons, I don't know if it was mechanical failure, electrical failure. They'll have to look into this before he's allowed to fly again or even test. And then that puts the end of the commercial business, as far as he's concerned, to a halt. The other guy is going to keep on going. That's X-Corp building the Lynx. And it's not as big as what Virgin Galactic had with Spaceship Two. That was designed to carry eight people, two pilots that would work for Virgin Galactic, and six passengers. The Lynx is designed a little differently. It's not going to be dropped from the carrier. It'll take off from a runway as one piece, go up to a suborbital flight, and then return to another runway. And carry one passenger, so one pilot, one passenger, sit side by side in a spacesuit. That's the other thing. Virgin Galactic had plans of doing this without people in any kind of spaces. But we'll see how it goes. We try to always carry, bring the information of what's happening immediately. Right now you have, you have three people coming back from the International Space Station, and by the end of the net they'll land. They've already separated from the space station. Soyuz spacecraft, and on the way to Kazakhstan. They'll land on land, and that'll be the end of Expedition 40 here. And you have 41 up there now, three people, and they'll be joined a couple of weeks from now by three more. The standard crew of six will hold for quite a while, and not until eventually you have the Dragon going up with crewed people will you be able to extend that number. They'll probably eventually have standing crew of, let's say, eight on the space station instead of six. Right now, six is the normal number. And just wanted to mention the next thing that's going to be big in the news. You'll see it will be on the 12th, this Wednesday. We have the delay lander, part of the Rosetta spacecraft that will land on that comet B67, and that's coming up this Wednesday, and I think they'll have a confirmation of that probably around 10:30 or 11 o'clock on Wednesday. NASA has three instruments on board the Rosetta spacecraft. I couldn't find any on the lander. Maybe they have one of them too, but I think there's like 10 instruments on each, all kinds of detectors, naturally cameras, of course, so we'll see how that goes. They hope to, get like about a month out of the lander, but it could go as long as 3 or 4 or 5 months. It's solar panels, just like the Rosetta spacecraft, and a lot of little things going on, but I want to see this Orion spacecraft test. That's going to be interesting. The whole test from launch to landing is about 4.5 to 5 hours. They'll launch on the Delta IV Heavy. It's like three Delta IVs bolted together, and then the second stage on top of that. Actually, really a third stage. I think they consider the two booster rockets, two Delta IVs, really the first stage. The second stage is considered the center one, although they're all ignited when they take off. Should be an interesting launch. Those rockets are nothing to do with the Russians, by the way. They're 100% American. The hydrogen fuel, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, similar to the space shuttle. The way that was. But the difference is you'll notice a yellow flame coming out of the bottom of the three boosters. And the reason for that is they have an ablative coating on the inside of the rockets to get rid of the heat, whereas the space shuttle had a complicated cooling system to keep the rockets cool. They didn't have that ablative material that's going to dissipate. So when the shuttle went up, if you weren't looking at the solid boosters on the shuttle, you look at the rocket itself, three main engines of the shuttle, the RS-25s that they used, reusable. They were all hydrogen, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. No ablativeness, so you just had really water vapor as trailing off. You won't see that with the Delta IV Orion launch. A lot of bad things I'm covering here, Dick, so I think I better pause and turn it back to you or anybody else for questions or comments. This is WS2S.
Can
concerning the landing on the comet 67P, has anyone made a prediction as to how difficult it's going to be to land, dig in, set down your augers so that you hang on to the comet? The comet is going to increase its amount of outgassing as it goes by the sun, as it gets closer to the sun. I don't think it gets super close to the sun. I think it gets what? I think it's a it's paracentian. That's not the right word I'm looking for now. What do we call? It's not apogee and perigee. In the case of the sun, what is it called?
That's perihelion.
That's the word. The perihelion of 67P. Does that get somewhere between halfway between the Earth and Venus? How far in toward the sun does it go? If you remember, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know what the perihelion is going to be. I'm sure it's probably going to be in the Mercury area at least, but I'll have to look that one up. And, as far as landing, I read that the escape velocity, you know, like the escape velocity of Earth, for instance, is what, 7 miles per second, I think it is. If you were to land on this comet and you accelerated at 1 foot per second, you'd be gone. That would be it. That's what it is. So, you know, if you were standing there, you jumped off the comet, you would escape the gravity of it. You wouldn't even go into orbit. Very, very little. Got three landing legs on the Billy Belay, as they call it. And it's going to come down, and actually they'll probably have it going very, very slow. They picked the smoothest area they could find on this comet. If you hit some boulder or wind up in a hole, I don't know what's going to happen. But that's why they examined this thing the best they could. It looks like the flattest area. So they hope it comes down square. Got these harpoons that's going to dig in, and these augers that will drill into the comet. And that's another thing. How do they know how strong this comet is? You know, are these augers going to be able to really drill in?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Agency mission. Launched 10 years ago. Here it is. Kind of like their grand finale. If it doesn't work, they've got plenty of other information from the mother spacecraft, the Rosetta, and that will stay in orbit all the way around the sun. Take plenty of readings. They sure would like to have the lander stay there and take pictures right from the comet. So, cameras are really important. Like I said before, with the Orion going up, they have a camera looking at the Orion spacecraft from the booster, and so you'll see separation. Have cameras in the windows of Orion looking out back at Earth at 3,600 miles away instead of the 250 miles that the International Space Station is at. So cameras are everything, and that's going to be interesting. Photography sitting on this comet as it goes around the sun. Back to you, Dick.
They've got a very difficult job, in my opinion, Paul, to land on that comet and dig in. Any normal method of setting down an order, if you and I were trying to put an Earth screw anchor into the Earth in your backyard to act as a guy point for your guy wires for your tower, you would apply, let me pick a number, 30 pounds of vertical force to the screw anchor. At the same time, you're turning it so that it starts augering itself into the dirt. Okay? They can't do that because the total amount of gravity between the lander and the comet 67P is so small that any amount of pressure to try to insert the auger is going to be pushing you away. So it's got to be some kind of a simultaneous thrusting, pushing you down at the same time that you're pushing forward with the probe that you're going to be sticking into the soil. Or maybe it's going to be fired like a gunshot, if you know what I mean. You've got to be careful how you do this. otherwise you're going to be repelling yourself. If an astronaut tried walking on that comet, assuming now that your memory was correct, that 1 foot per second is escape velocity, and an astronaut's going to walk across that